lesson in it? Like what I just said is a lesson, right?
Gossip is in what we call namima, which is telling tales about people using their names that has no value.
So that
has value. Plus, you didn't even make tasrih of the person's name. You didn't even say their name. So, and also we do have in our religion cautionary tales, lessons. We actually have we believe in that a lot. The Quran is all lessons. Quran tells us, go look at the failures before you, so you can take a lesson. So if we never talked about how horrible certain behaviors can be, right, then why would we ever worry about it? Actually, then the closer the incident, the better. So we have the opposite. So in the authority in our religion is in the past, the Quran and the Hadith. That's the authority. However, the effect is the opposite. So in terms of authority, the further back you go, the more authoritative your evidence. However, the closer you get to the actual lesson, the more effective. So we know that a lot of bad things happen in the past, but nobody takes heed until it happens in the community. Then we all take heed, right? The same thing happens for hundreds of years. However, the nature of the human being is he doesn't take effect, or he doesn't take heed unless he sees it himself. Right? So this is also from the meanings of عِلْمُ الْيَقِينَ عَيْنُ الْيَقِينَ and حَقُّ الْيَقِينَ, the three levels of certainty, theoretical certainty, and then عَيْنُ الْيَقِينَ is that you actually see it, and then حَقُّ الْيَقِينَ you actually feel it. So if we are intelligent, then just by knowing that Allah told us something is bad, we should stay away from it. And if we're not that intelligent, if our iman is weaker, then just by seeing other people far away suffer, we should take a lesson. And if we don't take a lesson from that, then we're only going to take a lesson when we feel it, when it hits home. Right? Let's take an example on community. By the way, that's only one meaning of those عِلْمِ الْيَقِينَ عَيْنُ الْيَقِينَ and حَقُّ الْيَقِينَ, which means the knowledge of certainty, seeing certainty, and experiencing certainty. That's only one way to look at it. There's other ways to look at it. But when we look around at communities, you find some calamities. You find a lot of calamities. You got drug problems. You have zina problems. You have belief problems, aqidah problems. People's whose beliefs are off. Right, they're becoming, they're falling into liberal reform traps. So you look at, and you have to take heed. Are you going to take heed from seeing it? Or are you going to wait till it comes home? So you have to take heed, and you realize these communities, there's always an anatomy to failure. There is never necessarily an anatomy to great success. Great success that's beyond the norm, that's from Allah. However, and you could say maybe passion is there, but a lot of people have passion. Like they tell you the seven secrets of why the top 10 CEOs have succeeded. Why is this a logical fallacy? Because they didn't tell you that they are the only people to apply those attributes. How many other people? Like they're going to list you seven things that the great CEOs of the world are doing, right? How many people are doing them and are not from the great CEOs? Like how many people are doing those same things and are failures? So the real study should be, what are they doing that nobody else is doing, right? And that very rarely exists. So to be great is really from Allah. However, Allah Azza wa Jalla has told us what it takes to avoid failure. And this is where the justice comes in, divine justice. So although Allah distributes success as He wishes, but He also has given us a formula to avoid failure. And this is the big ni'mah. He's given us a formula to avoid failure. And anytime human beings fail, there is always a reason. But anytime human beings have great success, there's not always a reason. Sometimes it's just from Allah, right? Like we could call it luck. And in secular terms, we'll just say he got lucky, right? Or he was just a genius. I mean, we don't know where it came from. But failure, always, this is what I call the anatomy of failure. That failure always has a reason behind it. And Allah has done this, right, so that we can take heed, so we can not be crazy. Imagine if all your hard work, if you did A, B, C, and D, and you still failed, then what is the point of working at all? So Allah Azza wa Jal has given us the right way outside, out of failure. So when we talk about failure, there's only one thing that we have to remove from that, and that is true iman in Allah Azza wa Jal, true belief in Allah, that's only from Allah. But everything else, respect, you can train someone to be respectful. Not being on drugs, being educated, doing, you know, passing school, all these things, there's a formula. Right? So when we look at the calamities of the various communities, and you see there are drug problems, zina problems, aqidah problems, organizational problems, there's always an anatomy to these problems. The intelligent person, before he takes any endeavor, he doesn't look at those who succeed. He looks at those who failed. This is what many people make a mistake on. They say, oh, look at this great player, I want to be just like him. Look at this great organization, I want to be just like them. You're only learning half the lesson. And part of that lesson you can never learn because it's just genius and tawfiq. What you should do is study the people who failed and see, why did they fail? Because they missed this. If they had this, they wouldn't have failed in that way. So always to study the failures helps us avoid failure. And the first step of success is avoiding failure. In any military, the first duty of a king is to ensure that his own capital city is not vulnerable. Only after he ensures that he has enough guards around the city can he go and send out an army. What is the point of sending out an army? Conquering 10 cities, then getting conquered tomorrow because all your soldiers are gone. And this happens all the time. How many times you see a stockbroker or these people on Wall Street making $10 million a year, then losing it all in 7 days? Or sometimes it's 7 minutes of the stock market crash on a Black Monday or something, whatever they call it, right? And in seven minutes, 7 years of hard work is gone, which goes to show you it's not real work at that point. Because no real work can 7 minutes take away 7 years. It goes to show you there's a lot of gambling involved in the whole industry. Wall Street is a whole other story. That's a whole industry that's gone insane, and we still haven't learned the lessons. So we, in America, in economics, capitalism requires it. You go for the kill. As for your home base, it's fragile, no one cares. They're just still going for the kill.
In psychology, they say supposedly part of the attractiveness of addictiveness is because it's intermittent thing, and because you
temporary.
You win sometimes.
Immediately, yeah.
And you keep thinking the next one is going to be
you're talking about gambling.
Yes, gambling.
Gambling is another addiction. Quran tells us it's an addiction, mm-hmm. Right? Quran tells us he lumps it with alcohol and all these things.
But they also. I think people think that they're not going to be the one because you see people that drink forever and live to be like 100 or something, and then you see people like what I was describing that die young and get
diseases. Yeah, I mean there are people who drink until they're 80, but there's actually Muslim. There's a Muslim guy. He gambled. He was a gambling guy. And he ended up one day going so deep into his gambling that he's a Muslim guy from Michigan, that he gambled off his home. I'm even wondering about these casinos, like they should put limits, right? They gambled out off his home, right? And then he lost. So he went home in the morning. By the time they got home, it was like 4 a.m., shot his wife. Shot his 5 kids, shot himself. So, as I tell you, all you need is one incident like that, right, to outweigh everything else, right? So, this is why addictive things should be stayed away from, and the intelligent one at first ensure no loss. This is the rule of law. This is like a rule of war and rule of business. At first, ensure that you will not lose, okay? Ensure that first, then try to win. Okay, and In our deen, if you look at the morals, that with the laws that we put in place is to ensure that the peace and serenity and unity of the families, individuals, families, and communities, and therefore nations, is not disrupted. That's the first call, the first. And if that's all that happens, then you've succeeded. Here's the thing, people don't realize, if that's all you have, how could you say you didn't succeed in life? If you have, you're healthy in yourself, you know your beliefs, you also recognize, you have a good family, the kids aren't on drugs, they're educated, they're healthy. Even health is up, sometimes it's not in our hands. You have a community, there's no zina in the community, there's no drama in the community, there's no alcohol in the community, there's no bid'ah in the community, okay? What? How could you not say that you're not successful? And this is the myth that shaitan puts. No, it's not enough. Look at so-and-so. They got a $5.5 billion budget. Look at this masjid over here. They have a dome that's 30 feet tall. And then you start sacrificing what made you stable for this glitter, right? For the glory. You sacrifice the footing of your stability. And look at Sayyidina Umar ibn Khattab, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, so long as this man is within you, amongst you, you will never have fitna. Because this Umar ibn Khattab had such a perception on the nature of people, and he had such a perception that the foundation is 90% of everything, the foundation. The foundation is solid, that's 90%. Some people say, oh, it's like 50%. No, it's 90%, the foundation. Once you lose your footing, and that's why Umar ibn Khattab was so strict on Medina. If we lose our footing in the deen, and in our humility, then why should the rest of the ummah not lose their footing too? He prohibited people to eat meat twice a day in Medina. People think that's his fatwa. That's not his fatwa for the Muslims. That is his ruling, his judgment, and every khalifa can make specific judgments that he feels is sound. It doesn't have to be a religious ruling. For the people of Medina. Why? Because the Prophet ﷺ was just living amongst us. We are people, we have to handle such wealth and such an ummah that's unbelievable. If we are corrupted 1%, we're going to lose the whole thing. So he prohibited meat twice a day. He prohibited homes to be built so high. He forced a counterbalance to all the wealth that was coming in. He forced austerity. Austerity laws on just Medina. He said, we have to be the example. Everyone else could do what they want, but we have to be the example of austerity. Because once, إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَيَطْغَى أَنْ رَأَهُ اسْتَغْنَى. Once an individual has so much, he becomes corrupted. He becomes corrupted. He had such austerity laws, and people think that's his religion. It has not his religion in particular. It's not his fatwa for the all people. That is his policy of how to counterbalance wealth and success. And that's why the ummah succeeded. But now look, when these austerity laws were removed, then look at what happened. What is the end result? Assassination of Uthman. Chaos, absolute chaos in Medina. Sayyidina Ali said, we have to move the Khilafah to Kufa to get rid of the memories. The nightmarish 1.5 years that built up over time, and then after Sayyidina Umar's death, until Medina was under siege. So, this is a hikmah, great hikmah of austerity laws. And we should apply austerity to ourselves if we have so much. And America, just by default, if you're an average middle class American, you have so much, it's unbelievable. So much so that the human being, when he gets so much, he starts even becoming arrogant with Allah. Looking at the religion, what is this religion? Why do I need this? I'm not doing all this, right? And that's what's happening.
That's a good question.
probably look at some of the sociologists that have statistics on these things.
Not to romanticize, I mean, human beings, we're all being tested. You know, just because one is from some country doesn't mean that they're not facing the same tests. But I was just wondering about that. And as much as the gentleman here was saying that when you work in the world, you're around alcohol all the time.
Yeah,
and certainly, you know, we have friends who come to this country and they go, why? And they support it.
Well, that's at that point, kufr at that point. Because you support what Allah prohibited, that's kufr. If you do what Allah prohibited, it's not kufr, it's just a sin. Yeah.
The top 1% I'll talk of Pakistan, they have no problem, they have no morals, they openly drink alcohol, and even in their parties now they've started serving alcohol, the top 1 or 2%. So they have no restrictions, and then they can go to Dubai or whatever, Europe, and do whatever they want.
That's why many times I look at it, and many people have difficult times with their community. But the more you look at it, the more you realize, in a situation as we are in right now, you definitely can't be alone. You'll be picked off too easily by Shaitan. He'll pick you off. A family can't be alone either, because the kids get more influence from friends at a certain age than from their family. So what is community? I would say, if we are going to summarize what the meaning of a community is, I would say it's a set number of families that meet in a location to do certain things, right? I would say that those are the three factors. There's got to be a set number of families. It's not a bunch of guys or a bunch of girls. It's families, because you're going to pass it on to the next generation, and they're going to marry from getting to know one another. So families, they have to have a location where they meet. And the things that they do together, that's a third element, right? So if you define that as a community, then through those activities that occur in that location, you reinforce the basis of the community, which is the beliefs and the rituals, the prayer and the fasting and on these things, and the morals, the manners, the akhlaq, the law that we live by. You reinforce them. And through the fact that they're families, the children, the offspring of these people, they marry and then keep the wheel going. And it grows, right? So the more I think about it, even if a person is in a very, and many people are like this, not just, it's almost, maybe you could even say the norm. They go to the workplace and it's a total different environment than in their home or their third location, which is the community location, their masjid, right? And the Jews, they have their synagogues, and the Christians, they have their churches and whatnot. But my point is that even if the workplace takes you so far into another zone, right, where stuff that's going on there, the way that people talk, the nature of those people, well, the community life will balance you back, and the family life will balance you back, right? So you're outnumbered them 2-1. You're outnumbering the workplace 2-1. Your home and your masjid will outnumber the workplace, right? And even at the very least, you'd be embarrassed, right? If everyone in a certain job is getting tattoos, and I'm going to from work 8 hours to home and back, work and home, so 1-1. You're not awake for 8 hours at home. You're between eating and sleeping, right? And there's only one person waiting for you in the house. But there are 30 guys waiting for me at work, so work is going to win eventually, I think. But if that one, you pad it with a community, that means you gotta go for Ramadan, you gotta go for Jummah, you gotta go for Isha, like once a week at least, right? Average. You pop in for Isha, that will counterbalance whatever people experience at work if they can't control what's happening in their jobs. So that's why I always go back, and sometimes I think, oh my gosh, this is a day and age. Sometimes you just wanna go to Italy, get a little apartment, and check out from life, I have my olive oil, my sun, and my food, right? It's a sunny day every day, right?
Good food.
Good food, and the people are happy, but I don't speak Italian, so I don't really have to talk, right? You'd think that that's what we need to do until you die. But in reality, this is not, that's not gonna work. You gotta actually, you can do that when you retire, go off for 4 months and come back. But you end up have to having other families around. It's just, there's no way to escape it when I think about it. Yeah.
You know, I understand that there are some people that come and work in foreign countries. I mean, I've actually been to Jordan, believe it or not. But anyway, I think that a lot of these people are predisposed to addiction. I mean, I was Christian for, you know, at least 20-something years. And the thing is that even when I drank, it was only like once, twice a year. You know, it wasn't like, I never became addicted. I tried marijuana once, decided it wasn't for me. I was put on tranquilizers and I never became addicted, but so I'm saying I don't have that.
Yeah,
no. But even if they come over, I mean, you know, probably being in an Islamic country prevents them from actually, you know, imbibing, and they have the community and everything, but I'm saying that I think that they have the natural addiction, you know, because for some people it's very hard, for some people it's much easier.
There are some people who are weak magnets and some people who are strong magnets. Some people, they just cannot control themselves, and that's a fact, right? It doesn't mean they're morally less, but they're vulnerable. But they're not morally less responsible, but they're vulnerable. And the thing is that in England, you go to England, what the Sharia seeks to avoid, we know there are always going to be people who drink, right? But the Sharia seeks to avoid that it becomes a societal custom. Because you go to a place like England, and you don't realize how much the pub is part of life. I think they have the work-home pub. Even so much so, they don't have the laws that we have. For example, the pubs are community places. Where we lived, there was a pub. Everywhere is a pub in England. Every block, there's a pub. So there was a pub like across the street to the right a little bit. When you walk on Sunday, it's a family place. Everyone is outside on the picnic tables. They have the games on. They watch the soccer the same way we watch football all day. They'll watch soccer all day, right? And drink. And it's a family thing, right? It's not like drugs or something bad. It's a family thing. It's a total normal thing. So I think that's what Sharia is trying to... And by the way, there's some funny news, though. It's actually pretty funny that the pubs in North England, in places like Blackburn, Birmingham, they are complaining of going out of business. Too many Muslims. So they actually have realized that if the Muslim population in a city hits a certain percentage, your pub will go out of business. It's amazing. It's actually funny, right? And there's another story, right? And it's sort of sad because in the sense that there's another story that butchers have the same thing. When the Muslim population reaches a certain number in England, in a little town, and you're a butcher, you have to become halal to survive. So there is a story recently of this poor old white guy. I mean, for us, all these things are, it's the deen, but think about it from his perspective. So he doesn't know who these people are. He probably doesn't read. He probably never went to school, right? He doesn't know who these people are. All of a sudden, they don't eat my meat, right? So I have to cut it the way they want to slaughter it. So this butcher and his wife, they run the farm, whatever it is. They had to go hire a Deobandi, right? Brother came with a huge beard and a turban, okay? And I'm thinking, he has to wear that even on the job? He's scaring the guy. And there are these knives all behind him. And I'm thinking, subhanAllah, look, if these people really were scared of Muslims, you would not take a picture with a guy with a big beard and a big turban, black, just like ISIS, with the knives right there, right? So clearly, right, he's not afraid of him, but this guy saved his business. You can look it up. He saved his business by going halal, and of course he just had to hire one guy to do all the cutting for him.
My next country will be to America in 2019.
friendliest sector of the world is going to be business towards the Muslims. And here's the other thing too, I read in the paper too when they were just preparing for the Hijab Fest, amazing article. Italy, the runways, modest long dresses are taking over the runways. Why is that? Because in England, the customer of the future is a Muslim woman. Think about that. Like, you can't cut 20% of your business, right? So they're now actually, if these are the buyers, then we'll cater for them, right? So the question, my question is, with all this stuff happening, is to keep in mind two things. Number one, to be sensitive, to not forget our purpose. So if we're all accepted, if we become totally accepted and everything is halal and there's hijab everywhere, well, that already happens in Egypt and Pakistan. They don't seem to get the message, right? We have to focus on Allah and realize that that's the point, not acceptance. That's number one. And that's going to be the job of the educators. Number two, also the job of the educators, is adab. We should not look, and here we are conquering you people. Like Europe, that's what it is. It's a conquest. The population shift is nothing other than a conquest, because there will be Europe, as you know, France and England, if it's you're talking about a location like a zip code, it's always going to be there. However, if a nation and a people is more than that, and it is a shared heritage and memory of the past, then those countries will not exist anymore. Because the Muslim kids couldn't care less about what happened in England in 20, 50 years ago. They care about what happened in Algeria or Pakistan, because that's what they really, or they care about the Sira more so than they care about the Magna Carta, right? It has nothing to do with their civilization. So in that case, it will cease to exist. So we have to have some degree of sensitivity to this. We are not going around like a tribe versus another tribe. That's not what Islam is. You want to make the people feel that the Muslims have brought some benefit. You want people to feel at ease with the presence of these people, right? We do not come as, even if we came as military conquerors, look at how the Prophet ﷺ came as conqueror, with rahmah. So that's something I always think. The non-believers, do they view us as people that they will miss if we're gone? Or that, thank God, they're gone? Because until in Newark and Philly and Camden, the biggest populations of Muslims in terms of percentage, maybe not Camden, maybe it's Newark and Philly, but the Muslims there are a bit rough around the edges. And they have caused a lot of people to hate them. A lot of people to hate them, right? And hate is loss. Why should they hate you? Right? They hate the Muslims because they're so rough, they're mean, they're nasty, they're trying to steal your kids and make them Muslim. We can't do that. We really can't do that. Right? So,
I will ask comment for addicts.
Addicts, yeah.
The one thing that is very sad about the addicts is that they keep on thinking that they are not addicted and they can quit it any time. But that never happens.
Well, that's what they, they're trying to tell us now, that there's a spectrum of addiction. A spectrum of addiction. Yep. And we would actually like to, in Islam, we like to pin things down to some terms, right? And we would say either way it's ma'asiyah, but different ulama have put down different numbers that they believe would indicate if something is a bad habit. First of all, we don't even have these terms. If you shouldn't do it at all, like zero, right? It's not like...
Is there a compromise?
Yeah, there's no compromising here. There's no compromise like, okay, once a week, that's not an addiction. There's no compromise. So that's exactly the point. We don't want to compromise at all. So if it's something that keeps recurring, period, then you need to seek help, right? So we would have a very lower threshold. Some of them even said it's 4 years, right? You do it regularly once every 4 years, then you have a problem. Some people say this, right? Other people said 40 days, other people said 30 days, other people said 21 days. But, I mean, think about it. If you pin it as addiction is the bad thing, then non-addiction is an acceptable thing, right? Which is not going to be the case for us. So we really want to eliminate these things completely from our lives. Not that it doesn't matter whether we're addicts or whether we do it once a year, right? You want to remove it completely. So now, since this is a Riyadh Salihin halqa, it should probably behoove us to read one hadith at least. لقد كان فيما قبلكم من الأمم ناس محدثون. 1504.
Which one?
1504. Hadith, that's 1504, pages 1124. Book of Da'wat, Supplications. Is that, that's the bookmark that I have, unless you have a different bookmark. Right? What do you have? What bookmark do you have? Okay, so a little closer. So this hadith says, لَقَدْ كَانَ فِي مَا قَبْلَكُمْ مِنَ الْأُمَمِ نَاسٌ مُحَدَّثُونَ. There were, in the previous nations before you, people who were inspired. فَإِنْ يَكُ فِي أُمَّتِي أَحَدٌ فَإِنَّهُ عُمَرٌ. عُمَر. There are people who were inspired. If there is any such in my following, it must be Umar. Okay? Sayyidina Aisha narrates this in Sahih Muslim. Sayyidina Abu Huraira narrates this in Al-Bukhari. Okay? And the meaning of Muhaddathun is recipients of divine inspiration. It's also, we call it Mulhamun Ilham. In the science of Tasawwuf, they call this Ilham. And it is from the highest levels of gifts from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is to receive inspiration directly from Him. Now therefore, if that's what we're going to say, then we have to give some parameters to this inspiration. The first thing is that all inspiration is in the category of speculative knowledge. This is what's very important. Ilham, we believe that it exists because the Prophet said so, right? And we saw it amongst the Sahaba. And we saw it amongst the Tabi'een and the Tabi'een, and it's mutawatir that it exists amongst the Muslims. Someone is inspired with something. Okay. So what is this in the nature of this inspiration? It must never, it cannot, impossible to contradict the divine law. That's number one. It will never contradict the divine law. Because how can this, it come from Allah and Allah contradict his own self? It's not going to be possible. The Sharia comes from Allah, the Ilham comes from Allah, they most therefore match. So you'll never find an inspiration that will contradict the divine law. Right? If someone, inspiration is not an inspiration because someone feels it. It's an inspiration because he takes a course of action that afterwards all of the people see the positive result of it. Okay? So number one, it's speculative knowledge. It's ilm dhanni, speculative. It's not absolute. Number two, it is does not contradict the sacred law. Okay. Number three, will never obligate or prohibit. In other words, it's never obligatory to follow. Someone says, "I really feel I really feel that you should, marry this person." It's never going to be an obligation, no matter how inspired they feel. So, this is the nature of ilham. And what is the reality of ilham? The reality of ilham is that it causes a person to say words or do actions, right, that would not normally be the case, however, that would not normally be their course of action, however, results in a positive result that is testified to by all, that everyone testifies to.
Discount the whole person, or do you just take what you can and
if someone's speaking to you with evidence in religion, you take the theory that they're giving, the idea, forget the person. That means it could be the worst person, and he actually tells you something true, right? So what you would do is, you would do it, but not out of obedience to that person. So we have the example of Shaitan coming to Prophet Isa and saying, say la ilaha illallah. What happens if Iblis came to you and said, pray two rak'ahs? What would you do? What if he's Iblis came to you and said, pray dhuhr? Well, if you got up and prayed dhuhr, you would be obeying him. You'd set a precedent that you obeyed him. But if you didn't pray dhuhr, then you're disobeying God. So what do you do? We do what Sayyidina Isa did. Sayyidina Isa says, I will do it, but not after following you. So you're going to do it. So likewise, if someone evil, let's say an alcoholic comes and he corrects your tajweed, right? We have very crazy combinations in the Islamic world, by the way, right? What happens if that happens? What do? You're going to take it, right? But not as he's your teacher and your imam, no, right? You're not my teacher or imam. But I'll fix that mistake. Yeah.
Also like Shaitan told Abu Huraira to recite the Ayatul Kursi.
Yeah, well, he didn't know who it was. It was just a man. But the Prophet accepted the hadith, believe it or not. Iblis came in the form of a man in the month of Ramadan stealing from zakat, money, the food. And Abu Huraira caught him and he forgave him once, second time. Third time, he said, now I'm definitely going to take you to the Prophet. He said, look, free me and I will teach you something. He said, what is it? He said, if you recite Ayatul Kursi before you sleep, no shaitan will touch you until the morning. So he went to Abu Prophet the next day. And he said, and the Prophet seemed to have known what's going on. Because he said, Abu Huraira, who's been visiting you? He said, an old man is stealing from the food and I forgave him. And on the last day, he said, recite Ayatul Kursi before you sleep, no shaitan will touch you until the morning. He says, Prophet said, do you know who that is? He said, that is shaitan. And he says, sadaqaka wa huwa kadhub. He says, he's a liar, but in this he was truthful. He told you the truth. In this matter, he told you the truth, but he's a liar. So even liars, every once in a while, can tell the truth. All right, time for a break at dhuhr. Any other comments or questions? We can stop here. And otherwise, we're back to our regular schedule. Inshallah. May Allah give your antis a solid semester.
Shadi, can you turn this off?
You can turn it off.